So tonight I have an important topic, self-love or self-compassion. And I'll begin with a big picture. We think of self-love and self-compassion as spiritual topics, as very personal growth kinds of topics, very intimate, and it is. But in another way, they're very important politically and economically in the biggest picture. What do I mean by that? Well, of course, if I love myself, I'm not interested in harming anyone else. All violence really comes from people who are deeply divided with themselves. And so if you think about violence and the tremendous cost of violence and the consequences, the medical and the insurance and the criminal justice system, that's billions of dollars right there. You know, similarly, if I'm not loving myself, then my relationships are going to be all messed up. And, you know, that's going to lead to much higher incidence of divorce and broken families. It's going to lead to a lot of people living alone. That causes stress and disease. Of course, a lot of addiction is driven by lack of self-love. So all the costs associated with addiction, all of this is associated with self-love. Now, I don't mean to minimize any of these problems. Obviously, they're complex problems. But I would say that lack of self-love is a gigantic, unappreciated driver in all of these. I'll also say that another way that self-love, lack of self-love plays out is that there are some people who feel a giant emptiness in themselves. And they go into business and they try and fill that emptiness by trying to fill, you know, make as much money as possible, you know, profits over everything else. And that profits over everything else, of course, that drives a lot of the abuses of corporations, but it also ultimately is driving climate change. You know, so even climate change is affected by lack of self-love, you know? And again, these are gigantic problems with, you know, I'm not suggesting any kind of magic bullet here, but I think lack of self-love is vastly underappreciated in terms of its political and economic impact. And if a nation really could cultivate a culture that promoted self-love, it is incalculable how much stronger that nation would be, you know? And so that's kind of the political and social rant at the beginning of this Dharma talk. So what is self-love? What is self-compassion? And I'll start with some misconceptions, because self-love really, it's gotten a bad rap, especially in traditional Christianity, has a very bad rap. So first of all, self-love is often incorrectly described as either arrogance, you know, the person who walks around saying, I'm better than everyone else, I matter, nobody else matters, like that kind of arrogance, or some kind of miserliness, you know, someone who says, you know, all the cookies are mine, you can't have any, you know, like that kind of thing. And the funny thing is, neither one of those is love. The energy of love is expansive, it's joyful, it's buoyant. The arrogant person and the miser do not have the energy of love. Both of those are messages that come from pain. They don't come from love. So they're really incorrectly described as self-love, you know. Another important thing to say about self-love is that self-love is not self-indulgence. There's a researcher, Dr. Kristen Neff, who has studied self-love extensively and has done just written a number of good books on it. I highly recommend the author, Dr. Kristen Neff. But one of the things that she said is the number one reason people give for not cultivating more self-compassion and self-love is that they're afraid they'll be less productive. It's this incorrect belief that they need their inner critic there to drive them to be productive. And if they ever really love themselves, that they'd lose all their productivity. And I would say that makes me very sad. It's very sad when I hear the reasons people give for why they have to hold on to their pain, why they can't, why they need their pain, why they're making essentially a contract with their pain rather than trying to escape their pain. I will say that self-love, properly understood, involves healthy self-discipline. And one way to think about this is think about a child. Think about raising a child. Obviously, if I'm a parent of a child and I'm beating a child, all right, that's abuse. We all get that. But at the other end, if I'm letting the child run wild, do whatever it wants, I'm setting no rules for it. You know, the parent for who, for example, is afraid of the child's temper tantrum and is always trying to please the child. That's another kind of abuse. It's not as obvious that it's abuse, but if a child is raised that way, chances are their life is going to be a train wreck. They're going to have trouble in professionally. They're going to have trouble in relationships, you know. And so overindulgence is just as abusive as beating, you know. Healthy parenting is about providing age-appropriate discipline to a child and, you know, explaining the nature of the discipline, why it's good for them in age-appropriate ways so that the child over time is able to integrate self-discipline. That's one of the most amazing gifts you can give a child when you're raising a child. And so healthy self-discipline is a profound expression of self-love. And we can be productive from a place of joy, from a place of vitality, rather than from a place of fear and scarcity. I'll also say an important part of self-love is commitment. And again, think of the analogy to romantic relationships. We know in romantic relationships that commitment is a powerful way that, you know, people make the statement, this love is serious, this love is important, you know? Well, much in the same way, if we're going to say that our self-love is important, we say that by committing to ourselves, committing to some aspect of self-care, something that we know that is good for us, that we commit we're going to do every single day without fail, because that's what commitment is. It really means every single day without fail, you know? So discipline and commitment are huge parts of self-love. So self-love certainly is, there's an aspect of it that is yin, that is about tenderness, that is about accepting oneself and forgiving oneself and being kind to oneself and letting oneself off the hook. You know, there's also a yang aspect of self-love that is forceful, that's about going out into the world, doing the things that are going to ensure that your needs are met, asking for help, setting your boundaries, you know, pushing back on the things that are unhealthy for you, you know, eliminating the things from your life that are not good for you. You know, that is the yang side of self-love. Both of those are important. And so that's at least a brief overview of self-love. And I'll say at this point, I can talk about self-love, but I suspect that for some hearers, there's an inner critic who's saying, you know, forget about Mike's chin music. You really know that you're not lovable. You know, it's the nature of an inner critic to try and undercut any message like this. You know, and that brings us to the gigantic topic about healing. Ultimately, the journey of self-love is a journey of healing. I often say that in self-love, we have to learn to love the places that feel unlovable, accept the places that feel unacceptable, and forgive the places that feel unforgivable. And we do this through following a path of healing. So I'll briefly run through what I'll call the seven rules of healing, the seven laws of healing. Number one, transformative healing is our birthright. It is a possibility for each and every one of us to experience far more love, far more joy, far more connection than we currently do. It is part of our birthright to have the right to change long-standing bad habits, to loosen up, places where we're stuck to just transform our lives in a number of wonderful ways. That is a possibility for all of us. That's the really good news. Point two is the really bad news, that healing is really the most difficult thing that we're going to face. You know, that the path of healing is ultimately about facing all our dragons, all our inner demons, everything that I've ever wanted to push away, all the hard stuff, all of that I have to face. That's law of healing number two. Law of healing number three is kind of more good news. It's about the compensatory nature of the psyche. Yes, I am going to have to face all those dragons and demons, but within us, within each one of us, it's part of our birthright that we have the strength, the courage, the fortitude to deal with all of that. It's just the nature of the psyche that if we have the wound, we also have what it takes within us to face the wound. You know, if we have the poison, we have the antidote. That is just the compensatory nature of the psyche itself. The fourth law of healing, I would say, is that, and this is probably the hardest to relate to, pursuing healing is about our relationship to inner otherness. So within the psyche, ego controls, that's the part that feels under our conscious control. And then the rest of the psyche consists of inner otherness. Now, some of it is irreducibly other. Some places we have othered. You know, basically, anytime I say, I don't want to feel that, you know, I push that away, I want to avoid that, we're othering that place. You know, so some of our deepest places of pain have been profoundly othered because we push them away. And if you think about it, you think about, say, a typical inner critic. An inner critic is an inner other. We don't get any choice. Like I, ego, I don't get any choice about when the inner critic shows up. I don't get any choice or any input about what the inner critic says. The inner critic shows up on its own, says whatever it's going to say. That's an inner other. It is not under the control of ego, you know, and we have to relate to it as an other. Law of healing number five, on that theme, is that, how can I say this? When we're relating to external others, we have spent our whole life, you know, I mean, those of us who are, say, not in prison, we've spent our whole life training on how to relate in healthy ways to external others. All the moral rules we've ever learned, all the social graces we've ever learned, you know, like any one of us could walk into a room with strangers and we would know how to be gracious, we know how to be polite, we know how to be respectful. Like that's all stuff we just intuitively know, how to relate to external others. Well, the irony is the rules for relating to external others are exactly the same as the rules to relate to internal others. The same moral rules, the same social graces, all of that apply. But the paradox is that there are so many people in this culture who know how to be polite and gracious to external others, but they're mean and abusive to internal others, you know? And so part of healing is just about taking all those rules of morality that we already know, how to apply. We already apply them really on automatic pilot in all situations relating to external others. How do we apply all those to internal others? How can we be gracious toward our internal others, you know? Law of healing number six is that pain lies, don't be gullible. And for this, I'll clarify a little bit. I really like Race Mamenikin's distinction of clean pain versus dirty pain. Race Mamenikin says clean pain is when I experience something difficult, I face it fully, I feel through it, it's difficult, but then when I feel through it, I'm done with it. That's clean pain. Dirty pain is when something difficult happens and I say, I don't want to deal with that. I'm going to push that away. I'm going to distract myself. I'm not going to face that now. And it gets shoved into some corner of my psyche, and then I avoid it. That's dirty pain. Technically, clean pain doesn't lie. I mean, we're being honest with clean pain. Clean pain is honest with us. Dirty pain lies. And it's the nature of these lies, it communicates with the ego by creating painful verbal messages. And then the gullible ego, the gullible rational mind, which thinks that it's being rational, believes all those messages and then radically multiplies pain. You know, the head is an incredible pain multiplier to a very underappreciated degree. I often say that internal pain is a lot like advertising. The message of advertising and the message of internal pain, for both of them, they're very loud, they're frequently repeated, and they contain little to no truth content. You know? And so it's important to be as skeptical of the messages of internal pain as we are of what advertisers say. You know? We don't listen to every single ad and think that it's absolutely true. You know? We're naturally skeptical of them. The final rule of healing I'll say is, again, on this distinction of this process of dirty pain, when I say I don't want to feel that and I push something away, I give it energy by pushing it away. And the harder I push it away, the more energy I give it. And maybe stuff that happened to us in early childhood and we couldn't face it then, and we've been pushing it away our whole lives, we've turned that into a giant inner monster simply by the fact that we keep on feeding it by pushing it away. You know, we're giving it energy by pushing it away. All healing, by contrast, is by turning around and getting curious about inner pain, about exploring it, listening to it, and slowly feeling into it. You know, it is certainly true with external others and internal others that compassionate attention is remarkably healing. You know, if you think about it, if, you know, a friend or an acquaintance had just been through a trauma and then you encountered them just after, you know, fresh off this experience of a trauma, we all instinctively know what we would do. We wouldn't shove advice down their throat. We wouldn't say, ah, forget about it, let's go get coffee. We would sit with them. We would just be with them. We would give them compassionate attention. Compassionate attention is itself healing. It helps people to self-regulate. It helps them to ground and stabilize. It helps them to come to terms with whatever they're dealing with. I mean, compassionate attention really is, you might say, the secret sauce of all talk therapy, you know? And so the journey of healing is about commitment. It's about a daily commitment in one way or another of facing ourselves, of just being with ourselves, you know? And a good way to relate to, say, an inner critic, you know, any inner critic is ultimately an inner child having a temper tantrum, crying out for our love and acceptance. You know, and the thing to do to relate to an inner critic is to ignore the verbal content, which is basically lies, but feel into the underlying pain, sort of follow that thread back to the pain, and just feel that as much as we can, sit with as much as you can each day. And of course, by sitting with it day after day, you will start to integrate it and you'll start to build your capacity. The more you face it, the more you'll be able to face, because your capacity grows in the process of healing. You know, and again, if we were encountered an external other who had been through trauma, we would be extending to them allowing. Just the quality of allowing. You can be however you need to be right now in order to process, you know. Much in the same way, we need to be gracious enough to be able to extend to our inner pain the quality of allowing. Just allowing it to be however it's going to be. Probably there'll be some anger. Probably there'll be some grief. Probably there'll be some rage. You know, just feel into whatever it feels. But eventually, by feeling those strong emotions, we're taking the energy out of that monster. We're deflating that monster simply by feeling what there is to feel. And eventually it unwraps, it unravels, and it's ready to integrate. Ultimately, every single part of our psyche is made by love, of love, and for love. And even the place of pain that is screaming, I'm permanently unlovable, I'll never be loved, like even that place deserves more love than we can possibly imagine. So part of the journey of self-love is cultivating love and compassion and cultivating it through this through a committed journey of healing. But part is also contacting what I would call archetypal love. Archetypal love arises from the deepest layer of the psyche. And archetypal love is irreducibly other. We never identify with archetypal love. It's always something that confronts us as an other. It confronts us as a kind of ocean of love surrounding us at all times. A love that is completely unconditional, a complete unconditional acceptance of everything we are. Like any of our ego valuations of good and bad or deserving and not deserving are completely irrelevant to our type of love, which just abundantly accepts us exactly as we are. Now, of course, religious people will frame our type of love as the love of God. And the useful thing about that is if you frame it as the love of God, then it's very clear that it's coming from an infinity outside of you, you know? And I would say, really, it's kind of indistinguishable, and in a way, it's kind of a sterile intellectual question. Does archetypal love come from the deepest level of the psyche, or does it come from the outside? Does it come from inside or outside? That's kind of a sterile head-level question, you know, and kind of a Zen answer to that is, you know, knowing the answer to that question really wouldn't help you. What does help you is to open to the possibility of archetypal love and to invite it into you. That love is always there, and the more we open to it, the more it supports us. So finally, I'll sweep back for a moment to what I talked about at the beginning, the political, social implications of lack of self-love. Obviously, a country can't pass a rule, everyone has to do self-love, because it's something very personal. But you can imagine a culture in which, say, students learn something like the seven laws of healing, and just everyone learned that and knew that as part of being human. That would encourage more people to pursue self-love if they understood how it worked. And if more people were pursuing it, there would be more social proof, and then more people would be doing it. Not everyone would do it, but there'd be more of a sense of, I would be doing this if I were going to make my life better. Like, that would be a part of the cultural awareness. You know, I would like to think in some enlightened future, that would be the case. So I'm going to share the quote sheet. It takes a little bit of configuring here in my new arrangement. Let's see. Chat. Hold on. Why is this? Okay, I think I shared the quote sheet there. No, I have to find the quote sheet on my computer. Sorry, this is Jesus. Okay, quote sheet. Sorry about that delay. From the Buddha. The Buddha said, "If you search this whole world over, you will never find another more worthy of your loving kindness than yourself. And from this love, you will hold us all as dear. We cannot harm others when we genuinely love ourselves." He also said, "Let those who desire Buddhahood not train in many dharmas, but only one." Which one? Great compassion. Those with great compassion possess all the Buddha's teaching as if it were in the palm of their hand. And in particular, self-love is very much a way to hold all those teachings. Okay, a long one. It's from Melody Beatty. "Do you ever find yourself thinking, how could anyone possibly love me? For many of us, this is a deeply ingrained belief that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thinking we are unlovable can sabotage our relationships with coworkers, friends, families, and other loved ones. This belief can cause us to choose or stay in relationships that are less than we deserve because we don't believe we deserve better. We may become desperate and cling as if a particular person was our last chance at love. We may become defensive and push people away. We may withdraw or constantly overreact. While growing up, many of us did not receive the unconditional love we deserved. Many of us were abandoned or neglected by important people in our life. We may have concluded that the reason we weren't loved is because we were unlovable. Blaming ourselves is an understandable reaction, but an inappropriate one. If others couldn't love us or have loved us in ways that love us in ways that would have worked, that's not our fault. In recovery, we're learning to separate ourselves from the behavior of others. And we're learning to take responsibility for our healing, regardless of the people around us. Just as we may have believed that we're unlovable, we can become skilled at practicing the belief that we are lovable. This new belief will improve the quality of our relationships, will improve our most important relationships, our relationship with ourselves. We will be able to let others love us and become open to the love and friendship we deserve. Today, help me to be aware of and release any self-defeating beliefs I have about being unlovable. Help me begin today to tell people that I am lovable, to tell myself that I am lovable. Help me to practice this belief until it gets into my core and manifests in my relationships." So next we have a quartet of 13th century luminaries. The first is Rumi, who says, "Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it." Saint Magdalene of Magdeburg said, "The soul is made of love." Saint Bonaventure, the great mystic, said, "Enter yourself there and know that your soul loves itself most fervently." That's so beautiful. And even Thomas Aquinas, who said, "Well-ordered self-love is right and natural." Then a couple 19th century sages, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said, "What lies behind us and what lies before us are small matters compared to what lies within us." And Abe Lincoln said, "I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live up to what light I have." Agnes Repplier said, "We cannot really love anybody with whom we never laugh." And it's true, part of self-love is being able to laugh with ourselves and laugh at ourselves, you know. Willa Cather said, "Where there is great love, there are always miracles." And indeed, pursuing a path of self-love is opening to the miraculous. Jung said, "The most terrifying thing is to accept oneself completely." Henry Miller says, "Until we love ourselves, there can be no hope of finding ourselves." The poet E.E. Cummings says, "The hardest challenge is to be yourself in a world where everyone is trying to make you be someone else." Meher Baba said, "True love is not for the faint-hearted." Nadia Boulanger says, "Loving a child doesn't mean giving in to his whims. To love him is to bring out the best in him, to teach him to love what is difficult." Herbert Augar said, "The truth that makes men free is for the most part the truth which men prefer not to hear." And so a corollary of that is that sometimes on the path of self-love, we have to hear the truth that we would prefer not to hear. That is part and parcel of self-love. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, "Just to be is a blessing. Just to live is holy." John Bowlby, the psychologist who was really the founder of attachment theory, said, "We're only as needy as our unmet needs." Actress Lucille Ball said, "Love yourself first and everything else falls into line. You really have to love yourself to get anything done in this world." The Christian mystic Thomas Merton said, "To say that I am made in the image of God is to say that love is the reason for my existence, for God is love." The poet Charles Bukowski said, "Can you remember who you were before the world told you who you should be?" That one is so deep. Can you remember who you were before the world told you who you should be? The healer John Paracco said, "Love brings you face to face with yourself. It's impossible to love another if you cannot love yourself." Thich Nhat Hanh said, "To be beautiful means to be yourself. You don't need to be accepted by others. You need to accept yourself." Eartha Kitt said, "It's all about falling in love with yourself and sharing that love with someone who appreciates you rather than looking for the love to compensate for a self-love deficit." Maya Angelou said, "Love costs us all we are and will be, yet it is only love which sets us free." She also said, "Personally, I don't trust any revolution where love is not allowed." Ram Dass said, "Your problem is you're too busy holding on to your unworthiness." He also said, "You are loved just for being who you are, just for existence. You don't have to do anything to earn it. Your shortcomings, your lack of self-love, physical perfection, social or economic success, none of that matters. No one can take this love away from you. It will always be here." He's talking there about archetypal love. Joan Didion said, "The willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life is the source from which all self-respect springs." The Dalai Lama said, "If you don't love yourself, you cannot love others. If you love yourself, you will be able to love others. If you have no compassion for yourself, then you're not able to develop compassion for others. He also said, the planet does not need more successful people. The planet desperately needs more peacemakers, healers, restorers, storytellers, and lovers of all kind. Václav Havel, the playwright who was the first president of Czechoslovakia, said, the salvation of this human world lies nowhere else in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human meekness, in human responsibility. Rita Mae Brown said, I think the reward for conformity is that everyone likes you except yourself. That one is bitter and true. Jack Kornfield said, the two things that you're always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love. Zen teacher Norman Fisher said, we see now the only way that we could love ourselves is by loving others. And the only way that we could truly love others is to love ourselves. The difference between self-love and love of others is very small once we understand. And I think I would even add, there's kind of a feedback loop. The more I love myself, the more it allows me to love others. The more I love others, it allows me to love myself. So there's a positive feedback loop there. Sogyal Rinpoche said, above all else, we need to nourish our true selves, what we call our Buddha nature, for so often we make the fatal mistake of identifying with our confusion and then using it to judge or condemn ourselves, which feeds the lack of self-love that so many feel it, that so many of us suffer today. Shakti Gawain said, my willingness to be intimate with my own deep feelings creates the space for intimacy with another. Julia Alvarez said, I admit that for me, love goes deeper than the struggle. Or maybe what I mean is, love is the deeper struggle. Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg says, the simple act of being completely attentive to another person is an act of love, and it fosters unshakable well-being. And of course, being completely attentive and present to ourselves also fosters unshakable well-being. Bell Hooks said, if we give our children sound self-love, they will be able to deal with whatever life puts before them. Tara Brock said, I take refuge in awareness. I take refuge in truth. I take refuge in love. Llewellyn Vaughan Lee said, we are here to make the world alive with love. Amma, the hugging saint, said, love is the only medicine that can heal the wounds of the world. Then a long quote from David White. This is from a webinar during the pandemic. It's interesting to think that we have this lodestone inside of us pointing to our true north. And it's not only sensitive to the direction, but to the closeness and intimacy. And through it, we can actually measure our distance. And sometimes it can be a distant, that's distant even from the distance from where we are. And other times it can feel like a distance that is possibly crossable. And one is a state of exile, and the other actually can be a state of shyness. And this other can be a state of fear as we are getting closer to what we want. Part of the self-compassionate understanding is when you reach it, you're actually about to die. You will not survive the intimacy itself. You don't come out of the other side the same person you were that went in. There's a giving up. There's a massive kind of inner corporate downsizing, where large parts of you that didn't think you were worthy of your approaching have to be let go and have to go off and be employed elsewhere. This massive kind of radical simplification into what we call the soul, which is really the faculty of intimate belonging inside every human being. Kristen Chernoff said, If you can learn to love yourself and all the flaws, you can love other people so much better. And that makes you so happy. Tina Fey says quite simply, do your thing and don't care if they don't like it. Tyra Banks says, love has very to do with how you feel about your outer self. It's about accepting all of yourself. Steve Maraboli said, How would your life be different if you stopped allowing other people to dilute or poison your day with their words and opinions? Let today be the day you stand strong in the truth of your beauty and your journey through the day, and you journey through the day without attachment to the validation of others. Daniel Kuepke said, despite what you may believe, you can disappoint people and still be good enough. You can make mistakes and still be capable and talented. You can let people down and still be worthwhile and deserving of love. Everyone has disappointed someone they care about. Everyone messes up, lets people down, makes mistakes, not only because we're inadequate or fundamentally inept, because we're imperfect and fundamentally human. Expecting anything different is setting yourself up for failure. Race Mimenikin said, to me, self-discipline is self-love. Your ability to have some self-discipline around what it takes for you to have a sense that you are whole and good and that you matter is about having the self-discipline it takes to take care of yourself daily and giving yourself what you need consistently every day, even when you don't feel like doing it, to do that daily. And finally, the last word goes to Yogi Teabags. You don't need the love. You are the love.